you and the things that you like about me, the things that I get from you and the things that you get from me, that is already a result of the fact that we are in a relationship, a divinely ordained relationship which is built on mitzvah and a divine mission. That is the nature of our relationship. Anything else is only to enhance the mitzvah. So what's correcting the problem of sinas chinam? Correcting the problem of sinas chinam means, what does it mean hating? What's sinas chinam? Hating someone for no reason, or for the wrong reason, because you think they did something to you and they really didn't do it, or you think that you imagine or someone told you something about them and therefore you perceive them as being in conflict with you. They say over that Rav Nachman of Breslov was once traveling, and one of his misnagdim saw him and started cursing him out terribly. And he remained completely calm. He seemed completely unaffected by the whole experience. So the people that were with him said, how could you sit and listen to a person abusing you and the Torah, and your honor is not your own? You're a great Rebbe, you're a great scholar. How could you stand there quietly while someone heaps that kind of abuse on you? He says, because if I was who he thought I was, then I would deserve it. The only reason he's attacking me is because he's making certain assumptions about me. He heard certain things about me. He's assuming certain things about me. And based on that, he's right. He's doing the right thing. It just happens to me that I know that his information is inaccurate. So in other words, the conflict, sinas chinam means conflict based on either misinformation or sometimes even just the fact that my ego doesn't make room for your ego. There's not enough room in this house for my ego and your ego together. It's just not going to fit. There's no room. That's it. That is the conflict of sinas chinam. So what is the correction of sinas chinam? How do you correct sinas chinam? The way you correct sinas chinam is through avas chinam, through loving people even when they don't deserve, through doing things for people, caring about people, extending yourself to people even when they don't necessarily deserve it. But both sinas chinam and avas chinam presuppose that you feel and experience yourself as separate and distinct from the other person. That the conflict exists. Sinas chinam says that as a result of the conflict, you're going to hate that person. Avas chinam says that your commitment to overcome the conflict will make you decide to love and act lovingly towards that person. But the bottom line is that there's conflict. Avas Yisrael, so that the Rebbe says, throughout the generations, the degree to which Jews have extended themselves for each other, as much as there appear to be many conflicts and rivalries going on amongst the Jewish people, but yet, over these thousands of years, there have been countless examples of ways that Jews have extended themselves for each other above and beyond the call of duty, above and beyond that which a Jew is obligated to another Jew. And therefore the Rebbe says, that job of resolving conflicts by going the extra mile, by putting yourself out for the other person, that way of resolving conflicts, by trying to find a mutually beneficial result, that job has already been done. Now we have to progress to the next type of shalom, the next type of avas yisrael, the next type of unity. The next type of unity is a unity based on the fact that the only thing that exists in this world is God, and therefore there is no such thing as conflict. Conflict is only superficial. Because the truth is, everything exists only to express the unity of God. And therefore there is no conflict. There's no conflict. Because we're all one. We all have the same mission. We all have the same purpose. We all have the same reality. And therefore, we're all part of one reality. We're all part of the same God. We're all one. And if we're all one, there's no conflict. If we're living in the reality of one, then there is no conflict. Just like there's no conflict between the right hand and the left hand because we're all one. That's a different kind of unit. So in the old system, to give a practical difference, in the old system, if you're trying to resolve a conflict in a marriage, there's two people going on and something went wrong. So what they decide to call in a third party. They decide to call in a third party, and what do? Before they decide to call in a third party, they scream at each other. What are they screaming at each other? What are they saying? The bottom line of what they're screaming at each other is, it's your fault. Whose fault? It's your fault. And the other one screaming back, no, it's your fault. Then they go to consult the third party. And what do? Each one tries to convince the third party that it's the other one's fault. Okay? Very good. So what does the third party have to do? They have to say, listen, I really don't know whose fault it is. Okay? But you two of you have to get along. I mean, you're living together, you're a couple, you have a family, you have to work this out. So he tries to come up with a way, with some kind of solution to try to overcome the difference that exists now and maybe some future suggestions for what to avoid in the future, how to avoid a similar conflict. But deep down, each one knows it's the other one's fault that you didn't resolve. You just made sure that it shouldn't happen again. If the person is an effective third party. More often than not, they're not effective third parties, and the conflict goes on. Now, what's the new approach? The new approach is, who cares whose fault it is? It's completely irrelevant. It's a non-issue whose fault. So what? This is a marriage. This is one entity. And it really doesn't matter if it was the right hand's fault or the left hand's fault. It's clearly not an issue. When a person falls on their face, they couldn't care less if it was the fault of the toe or the heel or the knee or the eyes or the breath. Who cares? It's completely irrelevant. It's a total non-issue. We're all in this together. It's all me. It's one thing. We're not two separate things with two separate people, with two separate egos, with two separate agendas, with two separate directions, each one trying to get something else out of the other one. We're one entity. And if we're one entity, then the thing that's the most irrelevant is whose fault it is. Who cares? The issue is, what can we do about it? How could we practically make the fact that we are one entity, how could we practically express that in daily life? So you have to sit down and put the heads together and figure out how can we do it. But that's what we're trying to accomplish. We're not trying to accomplish the resolution of conflicts. We're not trying to accomplish ceasefires. And we're not even trying to accomplish, sometimes people say, no, listen, Shalom Bayis is not just about ceasefire. Shalom Bayis is about taking out time for each other and showing love for each other and romantic moments. It's not just avoiding the negatives, a lot of positive things. That's true. But even those positive things are all based on difference. They're all based on difference. The whole, in marriage, the whole, even the positive things in marriage are based on what's different about each other. Based on what's different about each other, so we can find positive things about the other one that I don't have without them, and therefore, how to get that from them is, well, if you'll smile, and you'll be positive, and you won't criticize, and whatever the different ideas and suggestions, how to get those things out of the other party that you want, which are positive, not only the avoidance of negative. But they're still based on the fact that we're two separate entities with two separate agendas. We're in a relationship. But the relationship also has mitzvahs. And we also have God in our relationship to some degree or another. But when our relationship is the mitzvah, God is our relationship. Without God, I don't want to know you. I'm not interested. God wants me here, then I'm here. My relationship is God, my relationship is the mitzvah. That, and therefore, if that's what drives me and that's what drives you, then we're in this together. We're not two separate entities. We're both the same thing. We're Jews who are expressing the divine reality together. And the way that we can do it most effectively is when we're together. So we're on the same side. So how do you get a conflict? There's no such thing. There is no conflict between two parts of one entity. Doesn't happen. There's no conflicts between right hands and left hands. So when people are still working on the resolution of conflicts, on getting the most out of your marriage, okay, you go to any self-help, you go to any bookstore, now self-help is one of the largest sections in the books. Go to self-help, you look at the section marriage, and what are the titles you're going to see? Some you can't repeat in mixed company, but most of them are all saying how to get the most out of your marriage. You're in this thing, you want to get what you got. That's the old way. I mean, even the old way, it's not the Jewish way. The old Jewish way was also not quite that way. But now, within Torah itself, the Torah is telling us that now we have to make the next move. We have to make the next move of not only that through the Kayach of Mitzvah we could overcome our conflicts, but that through the Kayach of Mitzvah we could become one. Through the kayach of the mitzvah that God gives us, we can become one. And if we're one, there is no conflict to resolve. There's no place for a conflict. Another practical difference between the old way and the new way. Another practical difference is that in a relationship where each one is trying to get out of it what they need, while at the same time learning the importance of giving and doing kindness. Of course, all of those things are true. But there's still an element of it that we're two separate entities, and there's what I need and there's what you need. If that is a basis for a relationship, then there has to be some kind of balance. There has to be some kind of balance. If I'm giving too much and you're giving too little, we have a problem. There's an imbalance. And when there's an imbalance, things fall apart. So you hear all the talk of, I'm putting too much into this relationship, I'm doing all the work, and you're not there, and you're not involved, and I'm giving too much, and you, whatever. The language of the times. But the whole issue of an imbalance is only an imbalance when you have two people trying to create a balance. When you have two people who are really, it's two separate conflicting entities, and you're trying to get them together in a way that they should hold together, then balance is a key issue in keeping them together. But when people achieve unity, then balance is a total non-issue. In unity, there is no giver and a getter. The giving and the getting are all part of the unity. That one part gives and the other part gets. Right? So I can use my hand to wash my back, and my back will never wash my hand. Ever. But it's irrelevant. Because the giving and the getting, that there be a balance, that is a total non-issue. So as soon as we hear this, all of our minds are starting to scream, uh-oh, it's not fair, I know what's going to happen. It's all going to get dumped on my lap. Another one of these rabbis is trying to dump the whole marriage on my lap. It's my fault, my problem. That's the instinctive reaction when you hear something like this. Uh-oh. Why? But again, that instinct is there because the underlying whatever you have is a sense of conflict. And therefore, it's a tremendous issue of, what do you mean? Now you're going to tell me it's my job to make this work. But if there is unity, not conflict, if we're working with the assumption that this is one entity that exists for one reason, to serve God and to reveal God's unity in this world. That's all it exists for, the only reason it exists. If that's what we have, and that's what exists, and that's its only reason for existence, there is no conflict. So the question is, who's doing more of the work? Whatever, who cares? I once heard two shluchim talking about shlichus. And one of them was saying, that he has to reach as many Jews as possible. He also has to raise funds for his work. Therefore, he makes it his business. He has only so many hours of the day, and he can only meet so many people during the day. Therefore, he has a choice. He can go to the poor section of town and knock and go door to door, or he can go to the business section of town and knock door to door. He has the same amount of time. He'll meet the same amount of people. He might as well go to the wealthier section of town and knock on the doors so that he can kill two birds with one stone. Besides, for reaching Jews, he can also do his fundraising. So he made a very good case for going out. And listen, I've only so much time anyway. I'm not going to reach anybody in this system door-to-door. Why not do big public events? So everyone is invited. But in my daily activity, which is primarily going door-to-door, I might as well do it in the wealthy section so that I can do my fundraising too. And the other shliachs were saying no. The other shliach was saying no. The whole point of shlichus is to give without expecting anything in return. Until you know how to go and reach a Jew who you don't expect anything from, who in your wildest dream you can't imagine that you're going to get anything back from them, until you could go out and extend yourself for that kind of Jew, it's all on the minus side. You're not going to get anything back. Until you could do that, then you never became a shlich. You never fully realized what shlichus is. Shlichus is putting yourself out not because you're expecting something back, but putting yourself out because it's another Jew. Because I am connected with that Jew without any expectation of return. In other words, what the Rebbe is saying, so each person was expressing a different level of Avos Yisrael. One person was expressing a level of Avos Yisrael which said, listen, you know, I have to worry about myself. I have to worry about my own life, my own family, my own needs. I also have an obligation to worry about other Jews. I might as well spend my time with those Jews who could also help me with my concern about my own needs. It's mutually beneficial. I'm going to bring him Yiddishkeit, and he's going to provide for me what I need. The other shliach was saying, no, we have to reach, the Rebbe wants from us a much different level of Avos Yisrael. The Rebbe is preparing us for Geula, and the Avos Yisrael of the Geula is giving with the expectation of nothing in return. There's nothing in it for me. To dafka, seek out those people in whom there's nothing in it for you. And if you see how the Rebbe was so involved in those who were involved with outreach to prisoners, and not just ordinary prisoners, not wealthy white-collar prisoners, murderers. The lowest murderers, and the Rebbe was mamish tremendously involved that they should reach out and bring to the lowest people, drug addicts and murderers and people on the lowest scale of humanity. And the Rebbe gave tremendous, tremendous encouragement for those who were involved in it, and they would sometimes bring these people to Fabrengens, and generally when a group of guests would come to Fabrengens, the Rebbe would mention them. And the Rebbe, they once brought a group of these prisoners, mamish, real prison material, and they came in and the Rebbe didn't mention it. So the Rebbe said that the reason why he didn't mention was that if he'll say that these are welcome to the prisoners, so they might feel bad. The people are going to look and say, oh, these are the prisoners. So that's why the Rebbe didn't mention. So in other words, the whole point, the point of dealing with a kind of Avos Yisrael that's not about goals. That's not about correcting conflicts. That's not about overcoming sinas chinuch. That's not the kind of Avos Yisrael we're talking about. So the kind of Avos Yisrael which has nothing to do with sinas chinuch, it has nothing to do with fixing anything, it has nothing to do with correcting anything, it has to do with preparing for a new reality. Preparing for and entering into a new reality, the reality of Geula. And the reality of Geula is, the reality of Mashiach is to be so connected with the divine reality that I experience what it's like to give without expecting anything back. Because the fact is, what do we say about Hashem? Who can give you anything? Who can give you anything? You, the Eibishter, God is giving all the time, and who could give you something in return? No one. There's nothing anyone can give you because you don't lack. Giving without the expectation of return is the ultimate expression of godliness. Giving, I don't need anything. It's not that I really need something from you, but I'm gonna, because I want to be such a good guy that I give without getting, that I'm not even gonna worry about what I need. No. Need is not an issue. The Chazal say like this, that the tefillah, the prayer of David HaMelech, is called tefillah le'oni, the prayer of the pauper. What's the prayer of the pauper? The prayer of the pauper is someone who doesn't have anything and is coming to beg and plead, I need. It says that we find in Tehillim a chapter that begins with the word tefillah le'Moshe. So the Medrash tells us that Moshe's prayer is the prayer of the wealthy man. What is the prayer of the wealthy man? So it gives a marshal of a king that says to all his ministers, anyone can come in, and to all his people, anyone can come and ask whatever they want. So each poor person comes in and they ask for something, and the king gives them whatever they ask. But then comes in his minister who's fabulously wealthy. He lacks nothing. And he says to the king, he says, for myself, I lack nothing. But you should know that in your country there's a city that is destroyed. I'm asking that for your sake, for the sake of the greatness of your kingdom, rebuild that city. The prayer of the wealthy man is he's coming to God, he's coming to Hashem, and he's not saying, give me something. He's saying, help me do something for you. I'm not, about me, I don't care, I don't need anything. I'm not missing anything, I don't need anything. I'm worried about you. I can ask whatever I want. You know what I want? I want something for you. Not for me. But the Rebbe says in the Maimon that every Jew has the capacity, since it says in Tanya that we each have a part of Moshe Rabbeinu in us. That means every Jew has the capacity to tap in to the innermost depths of their soul, at which the person has the sense of being an usher. I have no needs. Because my whole existence is not for me and my needs. My existence is to reveal the divine reality in the world. So I have no needs. So what do I want? I want something for you. I don't want something for you. So when I relate to people in that way, so it's a whole different world. And the Rebbe says that this goes even further than what it says in chapter 32 in Tanya. In chapter 32 in Tanya, he says, how do you resolve the conflicts between people? By making the soul primary and the body secondary. Conflict originates from the body and the animal soul. All godly souls are all unified. So if you make your body and animal soul secondary and your soul primary, then you will have love for every Jew. So the Rebbe says, it comes out that you have to negate yourself. There's a conflict here, and therefore you have to break yourself in order to love somebody else. That's not the ultimate unity. And you also have to negate the body, which means that you're loving, what are you loving about the other person? You're loving their soul. Not, the Rebbe says, the ultimate unity is when we're all one. So I'm as concerned about your physical needs as I am about your spiritual needs. Just, I don't have to negate myself in order to connect to you. And this that I'm telling you now, the Rebbe wrote in the last maimon that he gave out to learn, on Purim Katan and Tavshin Nun Beis, and there the Rebbe says that this unity that we're talking about is a much higher unity, is a unity which can unify even Jewish bodies, not only Jewish soul. The unity of Jewish souls presupposes that there is a conflict between Jewish bodies, between personalities and characteristics and so on. The Rebbe says that's not the ultimate unity. The ultimate unity is when I realize that we are all the exact same thing. We are Jews whose entire existence is nothing more than to be a dwelling place for God. Then we're all in this together. Then there is no me and you. And I don't feel my needs more than I feel your needs. And I'm not worried. And my relationship is not with another Jew is not based on need versus how much I could afford to give. That's not the nature of the relationship. The nature of the relationship is we're all one. And therefore I feel your needs as much as I feel mine. If not more. So shalom bayis means today, in the terms of today, what shalom bayis means is that the home is the point at which we can experience this ultimate shalom. The home is the place where it has to start. The beginning of experiencing the ultimate shalom which leaves no possibility for conflict. It does not allow for the existence of conflict. Not that it resolves conflict, it doesn't allow for the existence of conflict. And that type of shalom, that is the shalom of the ultimate bayis. When a Jew creates a bayis, the point of the bayis is that it should be a sanctuary for God, it should be a Beis HaMikdash, but there were Batei Mikdashes that were not permanent. There's such a thing as making a Beis HaMikdash that's not permanent. And therefore, there are a lot of the old way of making a house where you could have a house based on the resolution of conflict, based on mutual benefit. But it's not guaranteed permanence. Today, it's much more difficult to build a house based on resolution of conflict and mutual benefit. It's not working anymore. Why is it not working anymore? So one way you can look at it that it's not working anymore because we're on a much lower level. So if that's the case, then how are we talking about an even higher level of unity? And the answer is no. When we're supposed to progress to the next level, then the old systems don't work anymore. When we're supposed to progress to Geula, then the tricks of survival and Golus no longer work. The person who was trained as a soldier and he became the master of survival in the jungle, and now he goes home to his wife and children in the city, all his skills that he learned in the jungle are useless. And in fact, if he resorts to them, they're only going to make him trouble when he gets back into the real world. Now we're making the transition from a world of conflict, a world of goals, a world of battling with darkness, of seeing ourselves in the world on two different sides and fighting the world and fighting and therefore experiencing conflict on all levels, and we're supposed to be moving into a whole new reality, into a reality in which God is one and His name is one, in which the entire world is infused with the divine unity. And therefore, the old systems don't work as well. Because they're no longer, that's not what we're supposed to be doing now. We're supposed to be moving on. And the Rebbe is telling us that we have the keichus, we have the powers, we have the abilities, that if we make that commitment to move on, to transcend our individuality, to transcend, not in a way which neuters us and cancels us and negates us, but that our individuality is my individuality and your individuality exists to express the same truth. And therefore they're not a conflict. But that is how we bring both the shalom in our own homes, that our homes become not only a sanctuary, but a permanent sanctuary, and we bring the peace to the world, which enables the world, enables us to merit and see the rebuilding of the third Beis HaMikdash, which is meant to be eternal. And as Chazal tell us, that Yaakov was the one, it says that when Avram saw the place of the temple, he referred to it as the mountain. When Yitzhak saw the place of the temple, he referred to it as a field. And when Yaakov slept in the place of the temple, he referred to it as a house. And Chazal teaches that these correspond, each one, to the first Beis HaMikdash, Avram, Yitzhak to the second, Yaakov to the third. The third Beis HaMikdash is called bayis, it's called a house, because that indicates permanence, an eternal edifice to God in this physical world. And this is, we accomplish through our endeavors, and as the Rebbe always says, simply by undertaking to do something. God doesn't have to wait till we actually do it, because He knows everything in advance. So simply by undertaking to do our part in preparing for the Geula, Hashem doesn't wait and sends us the Geula immediately now. Okay, one second. We're now going to take some questions. Okay, the first question is,
what do we do with those marriages that are just based on resolutions of conflict? Just trying to survive.
Is there questions?
What would change in our perspective to make it the way you're talking about?
Okay, the question is, what do we do if we're already in such a marriage, which is based on resolution of conflict and mutual benefit? What do we do to progress to the next step, to change things, especially when it's hard enough just trying to survive in the existing mode? Okay, that's the question. The answer is that part of the process is so one of the problems that they always say when you talk about shalom bayis is that if you're going to talk to the men alone, so the men are going to feel that you're putting the whole burden on them. If you're going to talk to the women alone, the women are going to feel you're putting the whole burden on them. The truth is you have to talk to all parties together. You have to sit them down together. And it's not enough that one party should hear a certain idea. They both have to hear it. Otherwise, you have an imbalance. Otherwise, you have an imbalance that one side gets carrying the burden, which I alluded to earlier. But again, the issue here is, I can't guarantee that I could change anybody else. The only person that I have the capacity to change, I can try to inspire other people by informing them, and I can try to inspire other people by being a model to them. I can't inspire other people by making demands on them. My demands and expectations of other people might let them know that I think that they're capable of it, but it's not necessarily a source of inspiration and motivation. So when we're talking, especially when we're talking about something which has nothing to do, which is not working something out between parties. When you're talking about something which is working out between parties, so sometimes you have to pull one of the parties into it kicking and screaming, even if they don't feel like doing it. You have to let them know you have to do it. And it's going to be for your own benefit. But when you're talking about developing the kind of relationship which is not based on mutual need, not based on what I get out of it, so the only thing I can do is inspire myself, okay, is start living my life that way. And by informing the other and serving as a model of behavior to another, then I could possibly expect that they will follow suit. And especially in relationships, as we know that the nature of a relationship is, Shlomo Melech tells us that just as water mirrors a face, so too a heart mirrors a heart. That when you show love for someone else, they instinctively respond in kind. Not only that, but this is sometimes the case even when they're not present. Sometimes a person could be having a loving thought about someone else, and that will arouse that person who's far away from them to start thinking about them. The power of an emotional bond is something that goes a lot deeper than what we could measure in physical terms. And the nature of it is that heart responds to heart in kind. So when I am living my life that way, then the results that I get and the response that I get is the same kind of response. So the chiddush of what the Rebbe is telling us here, I mean the novel breakthrough of what the Rebbe is telling us here is that in earlier generations, the concept of giving unconditionally was perceived as a sacrifice. And there is room in Judaism for sacrifice. In Chassidus holds Mesiras Nefesh, self-sacrifice, to be one of the greatest things that a person could achieve, is self-sacrifice. So traditionally, giving for another without any expectation of something in return was treated as a self-sacrifice. You have to break yourself, you have to sacrifice yourself. What the Rebbe is saying is that in this new world that we're living in, if you give of yourself totally, it will not even end up being a self-sacrifice. It might feel that way at the beginning, but in the end, you will be better off than if you didn't do it. Traditionally, when a Jew was self-sacrificing, okay, most stories of self-sacrifice in our history, the person ends up dead. Okay, so we consider this one of the greatest, highest accomplishments that a Jew could achieve, to give up their life for God. But the fact is, in most instances where people had the Siddur's Nefesh, they were gone. It was it. So you gave everything you had, but that was it. And then you had nothing. What you had was it on the spiritual world. What the Rebbe is saying today is that since we're saying that there's a new physical reality, so now when you give your all, not only don't you end up with nothing, but you end up with more than those who are looking out for themselves. That's what we mean when we say a new reality. We're not just talking about a new level of spirituality that I could achieve. We're talking about a new physical reality, which means that the proof is in the pudding. If you really, really do it, at the beginning it seems like a sacrifice. But if you really, really do it, you really make that kind of commitment, you really make that kind of what seems like a sacrifice, in the end you come out better off than those who did not make the sacrifice. That's what the Rebbe, and you see the similar concept that Rebbe said in relation to Shlichus. I always come back to Shlichus because I think that everything that Rebbe taught about Shlichus is the ultimate model for any other teaching of the Rebbe, because that's how you're supposed to live your life, that you exist as an emissary of God to reveal godliness in the world. That's your whole existence. So the Rebbe would say that it used to be in Russia when my father-in-law sent Shluchim, what happened? It was a question of you're going to last 3 months, you're going to last 6 months, you're going to last 8 months, but ultimately you're either going to take it out to be shot or go to Siberia. If you were lucky, you went to Siberia. And if you were really lucky, you survived. And what happened? They sent new people in your place. As soon as the person was taken out to be shot, they sent someone else. That's what it was like to go on Shlichus in Russia for the previous, The Rebbe says, I'm telling you that if you go on Shlichus and you give your all for your fellow Jew, and you put your fellow Jew before yourself, before your own career and your own material pursuits, you put your fellow Jew before your own spiritual pursuits, I'm telling you, you'll be better off materially and better off spiritually than if you didn't do it. So how could that be? How come in the previous generation, Shlichus meant you had to be ready to die literally, because you did, more often than not, you did whether you were ready or not. And today, it means, the Rebbe says, if you do it the way I tell you to do it, then you'll end up better off than those who didn't go. Materially and spiritually. How could that be? Because we're living in a different reality. The world is a different world. It's a world that's ready for living Geula. But you have to live it. You have to do it. You can't just think about it. You can't just learn about it. You can't just get inspired and excited about the ideas. You have to put out. You have to get out there and put out. Really put someone else before yourself. At all costs. And then you will discover that we're living in a new world. But you can't walk into it. It's not like you're going to stick one toe in the swimming pool and see if it's, you're going to go. It doesn't work that way. And see if the other one is responding now. Oh, if they're not responding, the whole thing's not worth it. So then you're again in for mutual benefit. The idea is that whoever it is that becomes aware of this idea has to, in their mind, close the door on the old system of man and open up a new door. This is what my marriage is about. At least my part. At least what I can put into it. If that's what my marriage is about, then my marriage will become that. The only issue of who's going to do more work, who's going to do less work, is only an issue if you're back, once you're into that, so you're back in the old system. So then you can turn around and say to me, well, Lord, now you're putting me on a guilt trip. Now, if my marriage isn't this unbelievable super unity marriage, then I'm guilty because I heard about these ideas. I didn't do it. But again, all these issues are irrelevant. All these issues are irrelevant. Who's guilty? I am guilty. I'm not guilty. All of the issues of guilt and non-guilt are what I'm living with my own little private agenda.
And right and wrong. Who's right?
Who's fault in it? Right. The question is, it might matter. Right or wrong might matter. If we're both looking at it from the same side, that we're on the same side, and being on the same side, we want to do what's right, and we don't want to do what's wrong, therefore we will look into, is this type of behavior right or wrong? But it's not an issue, is your fault, my fault? The issue is, how does a person who's living their life in creating a home, which is a microcosm of the ultimate Beis Hamikdash, a place where divine unity reigns. How does a person in such a situation behave? So we could sit down. We're both on. That's what we're both trying to accomplish. And we sit down and we can both figure out how do such people behave, and then try to implement it in our lives. Will we be successful instantaneously? Probably not. Like everything else in life, you work. When you work at it, you see results. But at least you have to know where we're going and how you plan on getting there. And then you have to do the work. So, but it's not a question of who, how many people are doing it, who's doing it. If as long as one party is in it, and again, it would be a good idea that both parties should be aware of what they're trying to achieve together. Obviously, that's if they want to achieve it together, it will be a lot more effective if both parties are aware. But it's not essential. It's a good idea. They should be informed, and like I said, the one who is inspired and motivated could serve as a model for the other. You can't necessarily demand that another person, because if you're demanding it, then it's not, then you're ready. It's not that kind of unity that we're looking for. Any other questions?
I don't know if this is like a very simple view of what you're saying, and the message is that you skipped out that divorce is definitely an option. That even if the one part, both parties see God as a part of the relationship, that one side doesn't act the way she's supposed to be acting in the relationship. Like, to more of a degree that he didn't come home on time, he didn't clean up after him, you know, to abuse, whatever, so that there's definitely a place for divorce.
Again. There are things in Torah. See, I have to be careful that what I say. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. I don't want anyone to be upset or have any kindness on me. However, the fact is like this: that there is a system. The Torah, as we see it, okay, a lot of it is written in how to deal with an imperfect world, and therefore, in how to deal with an imperfect world, in a world that is full of conflicts. When you're in a situation where those conflicts are not resolved, then the Torah gives an option of how to deal. Of another option of resolving the conflict is by separating. But that's when you're living in an imperfect world with conflicts in which you have to now focus, and you're focused on resolution of conflicts. Sometimes you have no choice but to separate. When you're living in a perfect world, or you're at least committed to making your world a perfect world, okay? In a perfect world, there's no such thing as conflict. So it's not that divorce doesn't exist. It's not that it doesn't say in the Torah that divorce is an option. The Torah does say divorce is an option where there is conflict. But if you're living in a reality where conflict does not exist, there's just not. It's not an option. Not because it's bad or good. It's not an option because it just doesn't exist.
But okay. So you're saying in our times that we're living in a community.
Sorry, we just have. Right. Okay. I just want to make one other point about the situation of divorce. However, exists a possibility that even though that while one person is striving to achieve this kind of perfect state in the home, the other person is for some reason or another intentionally trying to sabotage that attempt. If that is the case, then I mean, usually the person who is creating the difficulty could be prevailed upon by an outside help if you get the right kind of outside help. Sometimes even things which you know are good for you, it's hard to hear from the one who you feel locked in the battle with. So sometimes that person has to hear it from an outside source. More often than not, that can also be resolved. It can also be, the person can be brought around. However, does there exist a possibility that there's a person who will intentionally do everything they can to fight and sabotage achieving such a state in the home? Since we are not yet in that perfect world, that possibility does exist. And in such a case, then the person to consult would be your local Orthodox rabbi.
Okay, so you're acknowledging
There is such a thing that.
And, sorry. And that concept of the one date, and you could, as far as a perfect world, you could really bond with anybody, as long as you're not repulsed by their face, because you're not getting used to them as a person, or seeing their anger, their different characteristics,
yeah, because
before
the
you get married, because that doesn't matter, because if there's a God and you're both striving to the same thing, so he has an angry tantrum, I'm married, we're together in it, I'll go through it with him.
Right.
I'll also get him with one kid. We'll do it together.
It can be done.
And a person who goes out for 3 dates, 10 dates, 20 dates, have denied that Hashem is one.
No. The process of dating, okay, the question, so this raises a whole new question. The question is that if we describe the perfect situation as a situation where two virtual strangers meet under a chuppah and proceed to live married life together, then how do we reconcile that with the fact that we do have a system in which we are dating? That's a good question. The truth is that the way we can reconcile that is by keeping dating to a minimum, and the Rebbe would beg, plead, cry. There's so many answers from the Rebbe. Unfortunately, a very small percentage of people follow this request of the Rebbe, is that engaged couples stay as far away from each other as humanly possible. The Rebbe would ask that the boys should go overseas to learn overseas, that they keep as distant as humanly possible from each other. And a lot of people feel, again, we are affected by secular influences, and therefore people feel, listen, the closer we get now, so we'll start off our marriage.